Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Friday, November the 12th, 2021. On this edition of the Politocrat, a look back, 5 years later, at November the 8th, 2016, the U.S. presidential election, and the next day, early in the morning, November 9th, 2016, a look back at both and what we must do to ensure that we don't have what happened 5 years ago happen again either next year or in 2024 or ever again. Next.
Everybody should head home. You should get some sleep. We're not going to have anything more to say tonight.
This is a Fox News election alert. Donald Trump is the president of the United States.
It looked like a perp walk. He had written no victory speech. Never did a group of people look as sad to win the presidency as this crowd. At 2:29 a.m. on 11/9/16, our new leader's image was projected onto the Empire State Building. How the fuck did this happen?
Well, I'll tell you how it happened. It happened very simply. The Electoral College was the friend of the system. It is part of the system. And the fact is that he had at least 50 to 100 million people who could vote, stay home. So when you add those two things together, despite a 3 million popular vote lead that Hillary Clinton had, she lost because the Electoral College governs. The popular vote does not. Hello, I'm Omar Moore here on the Politocrat Daily Podcast. Thank you very much indeed. You made it to Friday like I did. Hey, we survived. We got through it. Woohoo, Friday, we've made it. Well, I hope the rest of your Friday goes well. And that you and yours are well and are in good health. If you're not in good health or not in the kind of health you'd like to be in, I hope that you are able to get to that place that you want to be in. And I do wish you all the very best in that endeavor and every other endeavor and all other endeavors for you. So I just want to start off with this because this is actually going to be the bulk of this episode. And I'm going to also talk about something actually that I didn't explain in the very last episode, yesterday's episode. I left with a bit of audio from a politician, and I'm sure you recognize her voice, but I will... maybe I should just talk about that really quickly now. That was yesterday's episode, right at the end there, if you listened, was the voice of Representative Maxine Waters talking about the police, talking about really George Floyd, and specifically talking about, I can't believe I forget his name, but the piece of garbage who murdered George Floyd, who lynched him. That guy, Derek Chauvin, who was convicted earlier this year of that murder. And so the reason I played that at the very end was not only to dovetail with the monologue I did yesterday about these two police departments, one in Palo Alto, the other in Palo Alto, California, the other in, I guess it's Sheffield Lake in Ohio. I also did it because last week I did an episode about Maxine Waters, I believe it was last week, and I was singing her praises, the representative out of Los Angeles. And I played some audio of her at a markup, committee markup meeting. I think it may have been the week before last. But as I always keep saying to you, dear listener, these days bleed into each other. But I don't remember when it was. It was definitely this month of November, or maybe it was late last month. It might even have been 2 or 3 weeks ago. And it probably was, actually. I think it was right near the end of October. And so there was a, and you may remember this if you're a loyal listener here, and thank you, regardless of whether you listened before or whether you've never listened to this, thank you for coming over and deciding to listen. It's really a great pleasure to have you and your listening ear and your time, because time is all we have. I mean, we have lots of other things, but time really is all we do have and is borrowed. And that you would take some of your very precious time in your life to go and decide to listen to me and this podcast is truly appreciated. So I thank you again. And I played this piece from the House Rules and Budget Markup Committee. They were marking up the bill. I believe it was the same bill that passed just this past week, the infrastructure bill. And so I believe that's the one they were marking up. And then it was this back and forth between Representative Waters, who was the head of the Finance Committee, and this Republican from North Carolina. Patrick McHenry, I think his name was, or whatever his name was, but that went back and forth, and McHenry lied about her, and I pointed that out at the time, lied about Representative Waters, and said, oh, you were threatening harm, physical harm against Republicans, and it's just such a lie. So I played that audio there that you heard yesterday, because that was the actual audio that he lied about. The Republican, McHenry, lied about to the face, to her face, Representative Waters' face. Complete lie. And so I played that audio, in yesterday's episode, right at the very end, so that you could hear it. But I didn't want to introduce it. I just wanted to just play it, because I think it dovetailed very well with the whole subject matter yesterday. I hope you do go back and listen to yesterday's episode in case you have not done so or didn't have a chance to. You should really listen back to that episode. But I want to talk now about this episode, which is one that I really should have talked about on the 8th or the 9th of this month. So earlier this week, I would have talked about it. But I think that the time is better to do so now, because there's just so much going on this whole week. And so I think the opportunity presents itself now to, as we head into the weekend, talk about the last 5 years. And we know what the last 5 years has been like across the globe, and particularly here in the United States. It's been absolutely absurdly awful. And the person in the White House at the time for 4 years was an absolute nightmare. And he really stressed people out genuinely. If you are a person here listening inside the United States, and you had been living in the United States the last 4 years prior to 2021, you know well that you would have been stressed the heck out by the piece of garbage who had ended up in the White House. And you didn't know what you were going to wake up to next. That was all 4 years of the previous person, as I call them, the piece of garbage, who wafted in and out of the White House and wafted out of there before sunrise. I mean, this guy is a piece of garbage, like I said. And I'll be using that term a lot in this episode. So fair warning to you, if you don't like that term, if you think it's too nasty, you can, of course, decide to move on from this podcast. But that's the least I can call him. And it's not too nasty at all, as far as I'm concerned. So I just want to say this. The clip I played there was from Fahrenheit 11/9. That's Michael Moore's documentary from 2018. It was put out, designed to coincide with the midterms of that year, to try to flip the House into a Democratic majority, which worked, because it certainly did. And one of the people featured in that film ended up winning her election. And that would have been the representative out of New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And so it worked. And Fahrenheit 11/9, which was not seen in theaters by very many people at the time, but has now subsequently on streaming platforms and Blu-ray and all the rest of it, has been seen by millions of people, did have an impact. The film is very dour, but it's not dour because it was Michael Moore's intention, a member of the global Moore family, to make a dour film. It was his intention to just make sure that all the bases had been covered. And I think about that film, one of the things is tremendously shrewd about it is the way that it does explain how a person like this piece of garbage that got in there for 4 years is able to and was able to. And also implicated some Democrats in this too. And quite frankly, also implicated the very campaign that won, in quotes, won the popular vote, that is. And implicated perhaps even Hillary Clinton herself. Look, I'm not here to rain on the parade of Hillary Rodham Clinton. I've said this before to you, dear listener, that I think her ability as a qualified person was exceptional. She, I think, in every estimation, is probably the most qualified candidate who has ever run for the United States presidency. I think that you will have very few objections to that, and the only objections you might have to what I just said is from people who just can't stand Hillary Clinton. Now, look, I'm not a massive fan of hers, but I have voted for her more than once. Voted for her in the presidential election in 2016. Voted for her in New York as a senator. So, look, this is not the first rodeo. And so, look, I'm not a big, big fan of hers. I think she has done more good than harm in her life. You know, there's some things about Hillary Clinton that I am not a fan of. I do think that sometimes she lives in a little bit of denial about her ability to radiate a sense of connectivity to people. That was one of the things about her, I think, that did not move on well to voters. She didn't seem to have the kind of spark that, say, a Barack Obama would have had, or even a Kamala Harris would have had, or did have, you know, to be quite frank, Kamala Harris, when she ran for president, didn't even get this far. She didn't get to the primaries. She dropped out because of lack of funds, and that's what it's all about in these campaigns. If you don't have money, you don't have any destination but going home, and she didn't even get to the primaries, and Kamala Harris therefore keeps her record intact of having never lost an election in her political career. And so that includes this past this past November, a year ago, when she actually won because, you know, she gets the Electoral College votes too for vice president. So I just think that there are some things with the campaign of Hillary Clinton. And of course, there's her campaign manager who I've talked about before, who I think just let her down. Stabbed her, gave her bad advice. I think this is two presidential runs in a row now for Hillary Clinton. The one back in 2008 and the one just 8 years later, where she was surrounded by people who gave her bad advice. That's my view, and that's what I'm sticking to. And I think that she does not admit when she's gone wrong with something or where something's wrong, completely in denial, which I don't think looks good for her. I don't think anybody, it doesn't look good for the piece of garbage that was in, and it certainly doesn't look good for Hillary Clinton either to deny what's right in front of your face when she says things like, well, you know, I don't know, I just think that this just happened, and I could have used better words, and I could have used a better choice of words, but never apologizing. So, you know, if you don't apologize, you know, and we know that this piece of garbage never apologized for anything. And one thing I think that requires leadership is to apologize when you've done something wrong, or when you realize that you've done something wrong, or when it's pointed out to you that you've made a mistake. You should own it, and you should apologize, and you should endeavor to do better. And one of the things that I find fault, just a minor fault with Hillary Clinton, is that she never really has done that. She's never really done that. And for whatever reason, and I don't know what the reasons are, but for whatever reason, she's never really done that. And I think that that's whoever it is, male, female, whomever the politician is, it's not a good trait to do that. I mean, obviously, if you don't think you've done anything wrong, you're going to be someone who is going to say something like this, but this is a case where things clearly went wrong, and I can point to a million examples. You know, I could point to what happened in 2008 when she ran, and she made that comment about RFK to the Pittsburgh Star-Gazette, I think it was, you know, or the Des Moines Register in Iowa, whichever paper it was. And she said, well, you know, the reason why I'm not dropping out, I'm paraphrasing, the reason why I'm not dropping out of this race is because, you know, RFK was, you know, was expected to win. And look what happened to him in 1968 in California. I mean, so, you know, it's kind of this, and she got heavily criticized for it. And I was one of her critics on that, because there was this implication by not saying it, that perhaps somebody might get assassinated in the 2008 presidential Democratic primary. And that was just really awful to say. And she didn't say those exact words, but the fact that she would put that out there before an editorial board is not good. Not good. And then not sufficiently apologize for what's happened. I mean, so some of that's on her, but a lot of it is on the campaign she surrounded herself with, the people, the staffers, and the people running the campaign. And a heck of a lot of it is on her husband. Her husband, I think, has done more damage to her than anyone else. I will say this again. Bill Clinton, in my view, has done vastly more damage to Hillary Clinton than anyone has ever done. And I include the piece of garbage in that. And you know who the piece of garbage is. I think that the most damaging person of all is, I also include Putin in that, because Putin benefits greatly, has benefited ever since with the disruption of the election here in the United States. He helped to steal it. You know, his dream of creating chaos and disruption in the United States was successful. It came true. And it's still today the same. You know, all this subversion, all this dark money, all the Citizens United, all the rest of it, is all what Putin wants. He just loves this. He loves it. And this has just destroyed a lot of things. That election 5 years plus ago proved to be a very, very consequential election, because now you have opened the floodgates to people who are clones of the piece of garbage, people who are tripping over each other, trying to get to the White House, trying to unseat Joe Biden and all the rest of it. And it's just a real storm. It really is a horrible horror show. And I think that, again, Bill Clinton has, I think, made it so much harder for Hillary Clinton in so many ways. Just think back to all the ways that Bill Clinton has done this. Just think of him. And recently he was in hospital out here in California. He was actually down in the UCLA area, Westwood area in Los Angeles. And recently, you know, he's had to really reevaluate how he conducts his life and his business, because, you know, he has some issues and he had to get treated for them in this hospital. And there by his side was none other than Hillary Rodham Clinton. And Hillary Clinton has stood by this man's side. And look, I'm not going to make judgments about what's going on. You know what indiscretions that he's done. I'm just thinking that she is in some ways very selfless, very selfless. And after all the things that he has done to her, Bill Clinton's done to her, she'd have every right to walk away from him, but she hasn't chosen to do that. I'm not going to judge that. It's a situation peculiar and unique to her, and therefore not my business. I'm not going to editorialize on it. But I do think that there are lots of things that happened 5 years ago and change that we cannot afford to have happen now. And there's something that we can do about it. And I'm going to talk about that right after this. King Harvest there, dancing in the moonlight. And welcome back, dear listener. Welcome back to this Friday edition of the Politocrat Daily Podcast. I am Omar Moore, and you are a greatly appreciated listener. Thank you very much for doing that. I really do appreciate you every day for listening to this podcast. And I want to get back to what the subject matter is on this Friday, and I hope you are having a good Friday and things are going your way, is the issue of the elections, not just the local elections that we really should be focusing on even more, I should be, but specifically the national elections and the state elections, because the audio that I played you at the start of this episode represents something that could have been avoided. I mean, I know that a lot of us out here will say that no one could have probably dealt with this. Whether it's Putin interfering, whether it's Facebook and Cambridge Analytica doing the damage that they did, extreme damage, both of those things did. Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. These were extremely damaging platforms and entities that really hurt any idea of democracy. They absolutely destroyed it. I mean, democracy in this country, as I've said many times, a million times, I think it's just never really been here at all. And it's never been here for everybody. That's for sure. That is for sure. And on top of all of that, and much, much more, with the Republicans destroying everything in their path, are organizations and entities, very toxic ones like Facebook and toxic ones like Cambridge Analytica, that really had a devastating impact in 2016 on the United States presidential election, but of course also earlier that year with the Brexit referendum in the United Kingdom. And that was extremely damaging. Both of those platforms, Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, did a lot of damage there as well. So there were other entities that were involved that perhaps made things very, very difficult to overcome in 2016. But also some of this, as well as the thievery from Republicans and stealing votes and all the rest of it, is also down to Democrats. I don't think that the candidates that Democrats put forward in presidential elections who end up winning the nomination are generally anything more than centrists. Over the last, if you look back at all of these campaigns over the last, I mean, nearly 50 years now, pretty much, in fact, more than that, almost every single one of them, and there's been maybe one exception with George McGovern back in, I think it was 1972, in the Democratic Party, almost all of them are centrists, if not centrist leaning toward the right a little bit. And people will say, like Joe Manchin does, oh, it's a center-right country, it's a center-right country. That's not true. It's very true, however, that the system itself is very much rooted in a so-called right-leaning and, you know, moving toward that end of the spectrum. There's no question about that. The system is, in my view, and the system's just behemoth anyway. But the country isn't. If you're talking about, and again, I always say, you know, this is three, what we have in the United States isn't really a country so much as it is 331 million different shards of, you know, of people, different glass. Shards, God, that was so inarticulate. This is exactly why I don't script the podcast. But the thing I'm trying to say here, dear listener, and thank you for being patient with your listening ear as I stumble and sputter through this like an old goat, is that all of these candidates may be centrist or center-right, and the machinery and the system definitely hews that way. But the people, the actual people in the country, are not that way. The vast majority of us believe in Medicare for all. The vast majority of us believe in the woman's right to choose. The vast majority of us support the Build Back Better agenda. The vast majority of us believe in expanding Medicare and Medicaid. You've had voters in Missouri, for goodness sakes, in the middle of the country, voting for Medicaid expansion, as they did in 2020, I believe, or maybe it was earlier this year, during the summertime, I forget which. It might have been last year. You've had that happen. You've had a lot of progressive candidates in these state races and in the House races winning these seats, sometimes in conservative districts, sometimes in districts where there are centrists and moderate Democrats who have been there forever or who have been in those seats. And in Buffalo, as I've talked about one or two times in the last few weeks, in Buffalo, New York, upstate New York, the Democratic Party was on track, to have a first ever socialist candidate since 1960 to become mayor of a United States city. It was going to happen after a massive, massive rebuke of the moderate Democrat who was in power. Until, of course, he decided to run as an independent in a write-in campaign. W-R-I-T-E, write-in campaign. And he won. And that was only after the machinery just ganged up on India Walton, the socialist. Democratic socialist. Just gang-tackled her at the one-yard line, at the goal line. You know, seriously, metaphorically gang-tackled her. At the goal line. Really. They had the New York State Republican Party jumped on the bandwagon against her. You had the New York State Democrats not backing her, in effect doing the same, very same thing. There's a very conservative Democratic machinery in New York State, and the New York system is fairly damn archaic. And all of this and more combined against her. I talked about this in more detail about a week or so ago. So there is more of an investment by moderate Democrats and Democratic leadership to stifle and stop the more progressive wing of their party than it seems to me there is an investment in getting these Republicans out of office and defeating them at the ballot box. Why do I say that, dear listener? I've just given you the example of one situation. There are many others. Bernie Sanders is the other one I've given you in the past, where it seemed to me that the Democratic machinery took so much pride and they expended so much effort in trying to get rid of Bernie from becoming the nominee than they did try to get rid of the piece of garbage in the White House. And prior to that, in 2016, more notably, with Hillary Clinton as the nominee, it was Bernie who absolutely was winning all these states. He won, I think, 22 states. Hillary Clinton won 24, 25. And when it came down to the convention, everybody threw their weight to the corporate, moderate Democrat versus the guy who is a Democratic socialist. So this has been done a number of other times prior to the two times I've mentioned, or the three times I've mentioned, twice with Bernie, once on a smaller scale in a mayor's race with India Walton just a few days ago and a few weeks back, and throughout the last few months, where the Democratic Party, the leadership in that party, the moderates in that party have spent so much energy and invested in trying to trample candidates in their own party, more so than the Republican. We've seen this in situations in Colorado where there was a progressive-minded candidate running for the House. And this has been documented, by the way, in Fahrenheit 11/9, Michael Moore's film, which, of course, I played you a clip from to start this episode. And there was a moment in there where you had someone who, I think his name's Levi Tillerman or something like that, and who had been running in Colorado for a House seat, who was a progressive, and he was running against a more moderate to conservative Democrat named Jason Crow. And if that name sounds familiar to you, dear listener, it's because Jason Crow was a member of the impeachment team for the House of Representatives in 2021. May have been in there in 2020, either one of those two impeachment teams, because of course there were two of them. You do remember that the piece of garbage was impeached twice in the space of 13 months. Twice. Not once, twice. But that's the thing. The Democrats spend more time trying to pull the rug out from candidates who the people are really excited about and who are voted for in large numbers than they do beating up on the Republicans. You know why? Because look at all these moderate Democrats. Again, another example. All of these moderate Democrats that keep losing these races to Republicans. And they really don't put up the kind of fight against the Republicans that they do against people like Bernie, against people like India Walton. They don't put up the same kind of fight against these Republicans. They don't run the same kind of campaign against these Republicans. They don't run interference the way they do against their own freaking candidates. The more progressive ones I'm talking about. They don't have presidents making phone calls and saying, well, you've got to drop out of the race. They don't make, you know, well, they're not going to tell a Republican to do that. But my point is that there is not the same level of animation against the Republican from a lot of these moderate and conservative Democrats who run in races as there is against the progressive who is running in their party that they want to actually get rid of. They spend much more ferocious energy and effort trying to dismantle that person than they do dismantle the Republican. Case in point again, another example of this, and I've talked about this before, dear listener, is the example of, and it's also in Fahrenheit 11.9 as well, Michael Moore's film, which came out in 2018. The long processional moments at that convention in 2016 where Bernie had won all of these states, and all of the people who were calling out the states in the nominating process at the convention in Philadelphia, no less, in 2016, the DNC, Democratic National Convention, all these states that Bernie had won in the primaries were being given to Hillary Clinton. I mean, there again is the superdelegates. I mentioned it earlier, but that's the superdelegates. And that's also the blatant dishonesty of what the Democrats do. And they did a lot of that in 2016, where they were cutting off progressive candidates at the knees. Bernie Sanders. There were lots of meetings across the country within the Democratic Party where they were, you know, talking in various forums. And it was very contentious because a lot of the more progressive Democrats, people, you know, not necessarily the actual candidates, but the people were seeing a lot of chicanery going on in there and a lot of machine politics. And none of it is illegal. None of it is immoral, although some might disagree with me there. It's perfectly legal to do this. It's called old-fashioned dirty politics, or as I call it, old-fashioned country hardball politics. It is. This happens all over the world. But the point is that you don't see this generally in the Republican Party. The Republican Party gets behind each other. They are ramrod straight in their objective, even if there are people who disagree in the party, and there's a few. You know, you'll get the occasional Liz Cheney sighting. You'll get Representative Cheney. You'll get the occasional Senator Lisa Murkowski sighting. You'll get the occasional, you know, one or two of the U.S. senators in the Republican side, the Bill Cassidys and the Susan Collinses and people of that ilk that you will occasionally see jump on board things. But generally speaking, any opposition they have is very tepid. And you don't see Mitch McConnell clamping down on them. At least not the way you see this happening actually in the UK back in 2019 when Boris Johnson removed the whip from something like 21 or 23. 21, 23, 22, 19. It sounds like a bidding auction, doesn't it? But Boris Johnson removed the whip. That means the parliamentary whip. They do not have standing to vote in parliament as a member of the Conservative Party. When you're having the whip removed, if you are in the Labour Party and you're having the whip removed, whip, W-H-I-P, removed from you, that means that you no longer have the protection of the party or permission of the whip for the party to vote in Parliament, in the House of Commons, for as a member of the Conservative Party or as a member of the Labour Party in the case of Labour, the Conservatives in the case of the Conservatives, etc., etc. And the whip is actually a person. And that person, you know, what you would do is you would typically, you know, you'd be guided by perhaps or directed by the whip. And that's the person that acknowledges your membership of the party. They do all kinds of other things that I don't even want to get into. And parliamentary wise, you have that support and guidance. But when you have the whip taken away from you, that means you don't have any guidance and you don't have any permission to vote in the House as a member of the party that you belong to. It happened to Jeremy Corbyn on the Labour side when Sir Keir Starmer removed the whip from him last year. Just over a year ago now that has happened. My gosh. October of 2020, I think it was, right near the end of the month of October. My gosh, we're over a year ago since that happened to Jeremy Corbyn. Good grief, man. And it's happened in 2019, as I said, Boris Johnson removed the whip from a load of Tory MPs who I think stood up against Brexit and against all the toxic garbage of it. And as a result, he removed the whip from them. So effectually, in effect, they were no longer Conservative MPs. They were only Conservative MPs in name. They didn't have any power in the House of Commons to vote on things as a member of the Conservatives. And as a result, you saw a lot of defections anyway. You saw people resigning. You saw a lot of people walking out and swapping parties. And then in the elections, it just went to kaput for a lot of them. But generally speaking, you know, it didn't stop the Conservatives from winning a majority overwhelmingly in 2019 in the general, in the worst Labour defeat since 1935. So that's that. But again, I get back to what I want to get back to, which is one of the issues with why the Democrats lose some of these big time elections. And they didn't lose the last one, I know, in 2020 in the general. I know they didn't. But here's my larger point, is that A, the party spends a lot of time trying to crush or tamp down any potential challenge in its own party. And that is a big mistake. That has to stop. Number one, right? Because as I've said to you just in the last 10 minutes or so of this episode, there is every indication that the country is much more of a progressive-leaning country based upon all the things I said about the way people are voting around the country. The country is becoming more brown, more black, less white. The country is becoming more diverse in its membership or in its constituency overall. And so it's a huge, huge thing to do, a very damaging thing to do, to attack candidates in your own party who are standing up for the very constituencies that you are going to need come election time, whether it's the local, general, whether it's state. So you cannot have this contempt for the voters, and the Democratic Party has for many years had an astounding level of contempt for its voters. Takes them for granted. I've said this a billion times here. And certainly takes black folk for granted, black voters for granted. My goodness me. Have done for a long ass time. And that's not me making that up. It's a fact. It's a fact. I really want to get more into what we have to do, because that's one thing I said I would get back to before in the previous block. I said that I want to get to that, but I'm also going to wrap a bow up on what we need to do. Well, I'll talk about that. And I will also talk about what we have to stop doing. And one of the things we have to stop doing, one of the things the Democratic Party in the United States has to stop doing, dear listener, is to stop attacking candidates that are progressive, who are running as Democrats, who are Democrats, and have a progressive vision. Please do not tell us that it is a big tent and you keep squashing a part of that big tent. That is not a big tent when you do that. That is a tent that does not want progressives to take the leadership control of the Democratic Party. That's what that is. Hence the making phone calls, President Obama, to all of these other candidates, all the moderates in the race, to clear a path for your former vice president, so that he could take on Bernie and that everyone else could throw their support behind Joe Biden as if he were some kind of knight in shining armor. And then all of a sudden, he starts winning all these states that he never campaigned in. Bernie campaigned in Minnesota and Utah, for example, and lost both of those to Joe Biden. Go figure. After winning the first few states that he won. So, you know, I smell the rat there. But look, that's now gone. It's gone, 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 as Johnny Mathis would say. Not to say that we shouldn't be thinking about that, though, but we now have a Democratic president. But I do want to talk about that. I do want to talk about what we must do. In fact, I'm going to go with what we must do, and I'm going to come back with what we must do right after this. Welcome back. And as promised, I just want to talk about what we need to do. And we've got to look at these 2022 midterms as happening right now. We've got to envision that this year is actually 2022. And I know that's very hard to do right now. But we're only 6 weeks away from 2022. And there are people in the world who have had a dreadful 2021 and want to get as far away from this calendar year as is humanly possible, which is impossible to do. unless you take some really drastic measures, and I do not advise you to do that. But we are six weeks. That's all that stands between us and 2022. And what we should be doing is getting into the 2022 mindset now. I've been talking about this all year long on this podcast. The need to organize, the need to have three issues, the top three issues in your mind, to write down, write a few lines about, engage with others about it, and then go ahead and make sure that you bring those concerns to the people in your people in elective office in your local area and beyond. We have to get involved. That's the clearest thing that we have to do. Get involved. One way to get involved, the first way to get involved, is to educate others, to learn, to acquire knowledge about the voting process in these states. And be sure that you are up on that and talk to people who aren't up on that. People that you know who don't pay attention to politics. People that you know in your family who don't maybe even care about politics. But politics governs every aspect of all of our lives, whether we like it or not. That is it. And we have to explain that to people who have this innate and very visceral resistance to politics. But we have to, even more so than that, educate them about voting and about what they need to do and why it is important to vote. That's the key. Why? You have to explain to people why. Because there are people who are just not going to vote. And we can't afford, with all of these Republican voter suppression laws, all these anti-voting laws, these illegal laws passed by Republicans across this country, we can't afford to just sit back. We have to be involved and we have to vote. And that means getting people out to vote that have never voted before. So one thing we have to do is get involved. We get involved by educating others, by having meetings and conversations with people in our families, friends, loved ones, you know, whomever. Family is loved ones, but family. I said family and loved ones. But for some people, that's true. Some people do not have the best of relationships with family members. So I do recognize that. But the bottom line is we've got to get involved, dear listener. This is so important. You know, no matter what country you're in, this all applies to your elections too. You need to be getting involved. You really do. And it starts with education. It starts with knowing what's going on voting-wise, knowing what's happening. And that's one way to do it, forming organizations of your own. I've talked about this all year. You also need to, I think, get involved in a campaign or two. Whether it's in your local area, whether it's the mayor's office, whether it's the board of supervisors, whether it is some other local official, school board, whatever, whomever, dog catcher, get involved with their campaigns. Offer to help, offer to donate, offer to volunteer, volunteer. If you've got a few dollars to donate, throw in a few dollars, throw in a few pounds, throw in a few euros, throw in a few, whatever the currency is, right? Throw it in and help out these campaigns and get involved in the campaigns even more so. I think that's so precious to do. Getting involved in a campaign means everything. You also get leadership skill out of that too, because you take on things. And take charge of things. And that's important too, because you have to do these kinds of things with your own energy and investment in it. Even if you are asked to do this, that, and that, you have to do it with a sense of urgency and energy and passion. And be the leader that you are. Even if you're not someone who's been given an opportunity to lead, lead by what you do, by example, lead. Even if nobody pays attention to what you do, lead. Affirm yourself. And affirm yourself particularly as well in these campaigns. Be about it. That's what you should do. That's what we must do. We must also be a part of and get involved with organizations that support what we believe in. We must get involved with organizations that are educating people on voting and doing all they can to do this and to keep going. Like Black Voters Matter, like Voto Latino, like Democracy Docket. These are but a few of many organizations who really are very important. Very important organizations. Color of Change, another important organization. We need to get involved with these organizations. We need to donate to them. We need to volunteer with them. We need to get involved with these places, because these are the places that we must go to. These are the organizations that are going across the country, particularly Black Voters Matter, on the grassroots level and taking tours coast to coast on buses, on their own buses, to get people out to vote. You've got Democracy Docket, who their legal teams, Mark Elias, who does really great work, and as do everybody, as everybody does at Democracy Docket, on the legal aspect and fighting against these suppression laws from these Republicans. Get involved with that. Subscribe to them. Subscribe to their. I mean, it's so important, Democracy Docket. And so is Black Voters Matter. So important. You can search these organizations and look them up. They've all got social media handles. Voto Latino as well. These are very important places you need to go to. Color of Change as well. Get involved. Get on their mailing list. Please, please, please. I cannot stress it enough. This is what we need to do if we're going to have a chance in these 2022 midterms, because we can all say doom and gloom and all that. But if we're not getting up and actually getting out there and leaving it all out there, then it's just really an exercise in waiting for the inevitable and just surrendering to this. You cannot do that. And we've got future generations to be worried about. We've got to look at the way this planet's going. It's not being run well. And the people who are running it into the ground for their own selfish benefit. That's what's going on. And we can't just sit here and go, oh, let's just watch. That's not good enough. And we need to do better than that. So we need to get involved. We need to join organizations that we care about, organizations that care about the things we care about. So if you are someone who wants to get rid of semi-automatic or just automatic weapons or assault rifles or any of that kind of thing, if you want to get rid of these assault rifles and these assault weapons, join an organization like Moms Demand Action. Join an organization like Every Town for Gun Safety. Join on these organizations. Get involved. Donate. Volunteer. Go to their meetings virtually. You can do this with any of these organizations. There's no reason why we can't do this. We've got all this technology, for better or for worse, and we've got to utilize it to get involved in these campaigns as well with these politicians. Get involved with the campaigns. That's the other thing. get involved. I think I already said that, but I'm going to say it again. If get involved with these campaigns. I don't care whether it's dog catcher or whether it's president. You need to get involved in these campaigns. Show your leadership skills. I did say that a few moments ago. Please do it, because it's just critical. We can't afford to just languish. And we can only, we could even spend, even if it's an hour every week, spend time with leaders doing what you have to do on these campaigns. Phone calls. Do the phone banking. We can do this. We have to be putting out a full court press, because the local elections are very important and these state elections in the midterms are very important. And President Biden is not going to have to get, won't get anything passed. P-A-S-S, as in Sam, E-D. Will not get anything passed in the House and Senate if we've got a majority Republican House and a majority Republican Senate. We're not going to get anything done. It will be 2 years gone to pittance. And we've got to stop that from happening. So we've got to get out there and hold everybody to account and make sure we get Democrats in and make sure that hopefully those Democrats are ones who are going to really fight for you and not just going to be content to hold a place in power. Because we can't afford that. We cannot afford that. We've got to vote Democrats in. I think that's a very important thing. And we've got to continue to keep the pressure on. We've got to call these senators. We have to get active, active, active. Not reactive, proactive. Dear listener, I believe the sooner we do that, the better off we'll be. And I think we may as well start doing it right now.
To the American people to win on November 2nd, I would be honored on your behalf to ask my good friend, Governor Reagan, to say a few words at this time.
And that was how the final night of the Republican National Convention in 1976 began. With Gerald Ford there, as you heard him, as President Gerald Ford, talking and introducing California Governor Ronald Reagan, a.k.a. former Screen Actors Guild, two-time Screen Actors Guild President Ronald Reagan, a.k.a. former B-movie actor, B as in bullcrap acting, film actor. Ronald Reagan. Bedtime for Bonzo, Ronald Reagan. And I play that clip because I knew this. And I instantly after I said this, I knew it. I forgot this convention. And I should have said this when I was talking about this in the first block, when I talked about the ways that Democrats stiff other Democrats. Let me be specific. The way that Democrats stiff, the moderate Democrats stiff, the progressive Democrats in these conventions. I cited the Bernie example in 2016 most vividly, and also what happened with India Walton and what happened to her, and what, you know, the kind of things that the system then does to knock off the Democratic candidate who may be caring too much about the people. Free. Oh, we want Medicare for all. Oh, that's too much. You know, we need to stop her. We need to stop her on the 1 yard line. We need to stuff her at the goal line. Gang tackle, 8 freaking linemen on the goal line. We're not letting her get past here. You know, seriously, you know, we'll have the Republican National. We have the New York Republican Party, the New York Democrats. We'll make sure she does not. Because that's, see, dear listener, that's when the system stands up in unison and says, get that weak stuff out of here. It does a shot block and blocks that shot into row Z. So the ball's coming into the basket, and then you got the New York State Republican Party, the New York State Democrats, and others just blocking the basket with a big-ass block that goes way up into row Z in Buffalo Stadium, wherever, you know, the stadium they used to have, their Ralph whatever stadium. because how much I Buffalo Bills, but you know, because India Walton is, by the way, a big Buffalo Bills fan. But that's what they did, and that's what happened. So look, this has happened a number of times in the Democratic Party, and there are also instances, and this is the most obvious one that I have cited in the past in this podcast, but forgot at this moment to do earlier in this podcast episode. The most recent example of this with the Republicans is 1976, which is what you just heard the audio from on the convention floor in Kansas City, Missouri, I believe it was. In 1976, the convention, the Republican National Convention, and the two main candidates vying for the nomination of the Republican Party that year were President Gerald R. Ford and California Governor Ronald Wilson Reagan. And that was what you heard there. That was the final night of the convention with President Ford, I think, kind of somewhat, I would like, you know, what did he say? I would like to, it would be a great thing to, you know, he wasn't even warm about it, because that was a very contentious convention. And I want to make that very clear. This does happen in the Republican Party as well. And it has happened on a number of occasions there too. So I don't want to look as if I'm just completely slating Democrats here, because the Republicans do this as well. As I said earlier, there are divisions in the Republican Party, but when push comes to shove, they all get in line and they stand up ramrod straight. They do. They did it with the piece of garbage that got in there 4 years ago. They did it with him. Just over 4 years ago now. 5 years ago. They did it with him. They kept resisting him and, no, we can't. Our party could never nominate him. And that's exactly what they did. Because it's a winner-take-all system on the Republican side. So that when you have enough delegates, you're in. There is no such thing as proportional representation or any of that nonsense as they do in the Democratic Party. That's what they do. Is you can't win these blooming states outright in the Republican, in the Democratic Party, because there's not a winner-take-all delegate system. It is strictly a proportional representation. So if Bernie Sanders won the state of California, he doesn't take home all, you know, whatever, 300, whatever the delegate count, 500 delegates, I forget. He didn't take home all the delegates. Joe Biden came in second, he takes a percentage of that, of those delegates. Then the third place person takes a percentage, and so on and so forth. So no one is in a winner-take-all situation anywhere in the Democratic Party's delegate process. It's just not the case, and I wish they would change that to a winner-take-all. Again, this is a way to ensure that the so-called progressive candidate does not go anywhere. It's like the Electoral College. It just keeps the system in place. And then the will of the voter is undermined by some freaking elector who can choose to actually uphold the will of the people or not. I mean, that's why we've got to get rid of this freaking Electoral College. It's such an, it's, as they call it, it's a badge of enslavement. I remember learning about that in school, learning about that in, I think, law school. Or maybe it was, I don't remember. Badges of slavery, badges of enslavement. I think it was, maybe it might have been in, was it high school? I don't even remember. But the bottom line is that this is what these things are, these systems are. And in 1976, you had a really darn close convention between Ford and Reagan. And it got chippy. It got a little bitter. It got bitter on the floor of the convention hall for a few days. There were these counter-protests and demonstrations on the floor inside the convention hall between Reagan supporters and Ford supporters. I mean, it got pretty acrimonious in there. And what you heard there was the end result of it. And 4 years later, Ronald Reagan would be president. Oh, dear. But I want to say this. The reason why I'm coming back to this is because I want to make a larger point, dear listener. And thank you very much indeed for, again, your patience and your listening ear, your loyalty, and your continued commitment to listening to this podcast. It's something that not only I welcome, I truly do appreciate. And I think it's way past time to give away a book again, isn't it? I've not given one away now for, what, a month? which for me is a pretty darn long time, considering giveaways. And, you know, there's another podcast I do, and I'm giving away things pretty much on a weekly basis. But that's neither here nor there. I just mentioned that because I just think about the fact that I've not given away any book or any kind of thing for the Politocrat Daily Podcast now for maybe more than a month. I think September may have been the last time, or maybe October. But I am due to give away a book again, and I will do that soon. And I promise that it would be a female author, not a male author, a female author. And so I'm going to be doing that and doing it soon, because I completely forgot about that. But the point I'm making here, the larger point here, dear listener, is that conventions are very important. They are for the nomination. They are significant. They are supposed to bring party unity, or at least iron out any disunity, in order to build for the presidential campaign, which will begin immediately after these conventions end. That's how it works. Now, it's a long, drawn-out process. In the United States, here in the United States, it's 2+ years between the time you announce and then, you know, the culmination of the election. That's a long time, 2+ years. So in 2 years from now, we should start to find out who's going to be running, or less than 2 years. I mean, it's just crazy for president. But anyway, the bottom line I'm trying to get to is these conventions are very important. And if you come out of these conventions with an uneasy alliance and peace, or a downright ruptured situation, your party is going to lose that election later that year. It's happened time and time and time again. And it happened, let's go back, shall we? Let's go back to 1968, shall we? Just 8 years before the 1976 clip I played there. 1968, case in point. All that acrimony on the floor of the Democratic National Convention. Now, that was quite a different dimension from 1976 that would come 8 years later, of course. But still, the dissension on that floor, I mean, because it was a case of the older generation and the new generation, and also injustice, and also violence by police, and also the way that there would be violent clashes instigated by police and what they would do. And it was just horrible. And it spilled out onto the convention floor as well. And there was all kinds of acrimony and tension and even violence. Violence on the floor of the convention. Dan Rather, who thankfully remains with us, and it's so good to have him here. Dan Rather got swept up in that as a CBS reporter, a young cub reporter, if you will. Not quite, that's a little bit rough, but he got caught up in that violence. Seriously, between people, between delegates on the floor of the convention, all kinds of stuff was going on in 68. That was a very turbulent, volatile year. I've told you, I think it's the most significant and consequential year of many years in the history of the United States. And there are others, but that one for me is the biggest one. I really do think it's one of the top two or three. Obviously, there's a Civil War. Obviously, there's Reconstruction. Obviously, you know, things like that. I get that. Yes. Of course, the end of enslavement. Of course, those things are massive. I'm not saying they're not. But I think 1968, in terms of a year, so many different things happened here in the United States and all around the globe, by the way, not just here in the US. But many things happened across this planet in that year that were just, really, I mean, it was such a big year, not big in a great way, but such a volatile year, 1968. And that year you had the Democrat National Convention. And my goodness me, you had it in Chicago. And I got to tell you, it was a turbulent one, because you may remember that Lyndon Baines Johnson had announced that he would not seek the nomination, nor shall I accept your nomination for the Democratic candidacy of President of the United States. I'm trying to give the speech verbatim, dear listener. But he said that in March of 68, that he was not going to be seeking any office to do with the presidency. By the way, his presidency, that first elected presidency, because, of course, in 1963, we know, all of us, that JFK was horrifically assassinated. And so LBJ was sworn in, but he then won in 1964 by a landslide over that racist wackadoodle, quite frankly, that, you know, anyway, I don't even want to, shouldn't go there, but, you know, he is, Barry Goldwater was an absolute snake and absolutely racist and, you know, just horrible. And so LBJ just blew him out of the water, and but Goldwater only won one state, as I remember it, which was his own, Arizona. So then it set up stage for 1968. LBJ was bloodied and bruised. He didn't run again. And so in his place, it was going to be his vice president, Hubert Humphrey. Hubert Humphrey was more of a, well, he was a moderate as well, but it was someone who had some energy in the party, not as much as, say, some of the others who were running for the for that office back then. I think Muskie was in there in 68, and Ed Muskie was someone, I think it was 68, who, or not 72, I think it's 68 now. Someone can correct me. I'm doing this off the top of my head. So, and I really shouldn't be doing it off the top of my head, but I am. And Muskie was somebody who was a progressive. Again, this theme has happened before. Much more left-leaning, much more progressive, had these bigger ideas about where he wanted the United States to go, where he wanted people to be, in terms of everything, health, wages, all kinds of things. And then there was some smear campaign against him, and just a bad optic campaign, bad-mouthing him, dirty politics, and then, you know, scandalizing him, painting him as this kook and crazy, and boom, it worked. And then Hubert Humphrey steps in, and Hubert Humphrey gives Richard Nixon a real tussle, even after the events of 1968 in the convention. Just, gosh. It was just, I mean, the election, because in comes Richard Nixon, his campaign, before we get to the election, his campaign was all about law and order, and, you know, law and order is the big thing, and we've got to restore law and order to this country, and we must do that now. I believe that we must restore law and order to this nation in 1968. Terrible. Thank my impression of Nixon, that was horrible. The bottom line is that Nixon committed treason in 68. I've talked about this a billion. You're fed up with me. If you listen to this podcast regularly, dear listener, you're fed up with me talking about this. About that infamous phone call that LBJ and Everett Dirksen, the Republican in the Senate, and Senate leader, I think, at that time, majority leader at the time, had with, you know, they had together that phone call. And LBJ says, that's treason, Everett, what Nixon was doing. Because Nixon was running interference with the peace talks in Paris on Vietnam. So the South Vietnamese were being instructed by Anna Chenault, who is a go-between spy for the U.S., at the behest of Nixon, that these peace talks should be vacated because Richard Nixon is someone who can get a better deal for you, South Vietnamese. So what you have to do is just wait a few months, because if Richard Nixon wins this election, he is going to give you a better deal. And so the South Vietnamese obliged. Bye-bye. We're leaving Paris now. Enjoy the Eiffel Tower. Enjoy the Arc de Triomphe. Enjoy the Moulin Rouge. Bye-bye. I'm gone. And they left. They left the peace talks. They left the table. This guy committed treason. He scuttled the U.S. position, did Richard Nixon. And it worked, because Richard Nixon got in and then never did give any better deals. And if, I mean, because what happened was the war waged on. The war raged, R-A-G-E-D, not W-A-G-E-D, as I just said, R-A-G-E-D. The war raged on. And it was all about Nixon getting in. And the thing is, there was so much disunity in the Democratic campaign in 68. With all that happened, RFK and everything else, it was just horrible. I forget now about Muskie, whether he was 68 or 72. But the bottom line is, I think he was 72. But I'll have to go check it. But this, don't forget, can't forget this. RFK was going to get the nomination that year. RFK was pretty much on track to be the Democrat. Can't forget that important piece of information. RFK, Robert F. Kennedy, was going to pretty much become, he was going to get the nomination for the Democratic candidacy for president. He was going to get it. And then, of course, he got assassinated. Not of course, but he did get assassinated. And then that left Hubert Humphrey, the reluctant, ooh, I'm going to do it. And then he came back in. And Humphrey, who again served as the vice president to LBJ, gave a good show of it. He absolutely took Nixon down to the wire. And Nixon won by a couple of percentage points, two percentage points or so in the general election. These campaigns and these conventions are important. And as I say, if there's disunity in these things, the chances are you're not winning in November. If there's an uneasy truce, as there was in 1976 in the Republican National Convention with Reagan and Ford, you're not winning the election that year. Because that's what happened in 76. After all of that dogfighting in 76, look what happened. Who won the 76 election? Jimmy Carter, the Democrat. So, again, these conventions are important. Because if you don't have unity coming out of that convention, the voters have shown you every time, a lot of times at least, not every time, but a lot of times, that they are not going to go for you. It's weird how that happens. It's like when someone says, well, in the midterms, they changed the party that they want to see in there opposite from the one that's in the White House. It's like, really? But the facts do bear that out. And I don't know why. Why is it that people go do this? Well, I want to see a change opposite to my party, so I'm going to vote the other people in. Or the other, I don't get that. Why? And is that even a thing? Is that why it happens? Or is it because the party in power is such a poor messenger? Or messenger. Not massager, messenger. Are they such poor messengers? Messengers and messengers? Are they that poor? Is that what happens? Or are the voters just going out of their minds? Oh, I just want to change the window dressing. I want to change the curtains. The curtains need changing. I'm just going to switch them every 2 years. But the bottom line, dear listener, is if you have party unity, the chances are you have a good shot. I'm not saying a guaranteed win, but you have a good shot. But if you're going into a presidential campaign coming off the back of a very contentious convention, not so much. Your unity meter, unity meter is going to run close to zero in some of these cases. Case in point, look at what happened in 2000. I mean, come on. Look at what happened in, excuse me, let's go back even more. Let's go back right after 76. Look at what happened in 1980 between the Democrats at the convention. That was one of the most contentious conventions ever. That was Carter and Kennedy, Ted Kennedy this time. And this is the thing that just kills me about Ted Kennedy. He's no longer here. But that's not what kills me about him. What kills me about Ted Kennedy is that he had the arrogance and the unmitigated gall to run for president 11 years after he killed a woman. Mary Jo Kopechne, Chappaquiddick, left that woman to drown while he swam to the surface and swam out of the river. Wasn't charged of anything. Nothing happened to him. And then, 11 years on, runs for president. Wow. Phew. Jesus, Lord have mercy, the arrogance of that. Oh, I think I'll go and kill someone, and in 10 or 11 years' time, I might just be president of the United States. I mean, it's really disturbing. But again, it's part of a system that genuflects and is protected by rich and powerful white men. And so Kennedy, being a rich and powerful white man, as the Kennedys were a rich and powerful white family, being as they are, they, you know, he ran for office as president. I mean, I wouldn't be, for president, I wouldn't go anywhere near. I wouldn't be anywhere near political office if I had done something like that. Taking the life of someone by leaving them there, because that to me is the same thing. Well, not quite the same thing, but good great grief, come on. It's pretty much. I would not, under any circumstances, run for anything. I'd be running for my life, hoping I don't get, you know, shot on the spot by some cop. Shot on the spot by some cop. Yeah, that's a rhyme in there somewhere. But 1980 was another example, dear listener. Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy. And there was so much acrimony between the two of them. They wouldn't even shake, I mean, Kennedy wouldn't even shake Carter's hand when Carter was, you know, when Carter was giving a speech. It was just so combative. That convention was a nightmare. It was a brokered convention. It was this horrible thing, pretty much a brokered convention. It was horrible. Horrible, horrible. It was pretty much a brokered convention. They were all, I mean, it was, Kennedy wouldn't give in. He wouldn't yield at all. And he gave his speech, and it was so bitter. And the dream shall never die. I mean, this guy, it was just, the speech was not about unifying anybody. It was all about him. And, you know, I ran the proud campaign, and I did this, and I did that. I, me. And my God, man, for God's sake, man, you know, you tanked the bloomin' thing. And then Carter speaks, and that election happened on that podium. I submit to you, dear listener, that the 1980 U.S. presidential election happened right there on that podium at the Democratic National Convention in 1980. That's where I think it happened. I think it was in New York City, in Madison Square Garden, I think, wherever it was. That's when it happened, and that's where Carter lost. And indeed he lost to Reagan, who also committed treason vis-a-vis the Iran hostages. Oh, if you don't release them until after I get into office, and I'm very confident I will, then you'll get a better deal. And that's what happened. And then all these hostages got paraded around when American hostages got paraded around and Reagan made it in. And there was a deal already made for the hostages to be, you know, released, you know, during Carter's time. And had that happened, Carter would have got another term. There's no question about it. But that did not happen. And Reagan got the first of two terms. And in the first year in office, his first full year, I think it was 1981, which would have been his first full year of office, he got shot. So he had a really crazy time. And again, like I say, the disunity on that podium between Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter showed. It was not even hidden. It was contemptuous. It was contemptible. And as a result, Jimmy Carter lost. There were a lot of other things that contributed to that, though, with Jimmy Carter. So-called Debbie Downer speech, although that's not the thing that was the reason why he lost. There were a lot of other things that happened. The bottom line is that that's what happens in these conventions. Then I jump forward to 2016, that convention too. You know, that was a convention that Democrats, again, it's Bernie, and so, you know, when you call out states that Bernie won and you say that Hillary Clinton won them, that's not going to go down well with A, the candidates, specifically Bernie, and B, the candidate supporters, specifically people like myself and many others. It's not going to go down well when you tell us that Bernie didn't win a state that he actually did win in the primaries. But I know that's the politics, the old-fashioned country hardball, superdelegate politics. Just outright outrageous. It really is. So, again, I just wanted to say that, you know, be careful of the disunity, because it can be a factor. It can be, not always, but sometimes. We have got lots of work to do, so let's get to work. And let's get Democrats elected to office. And let's educate the people. And make sure that we all vote. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore.